In a healthy family, the shame, the fig leaf, as we are used to call it, withers in due time around every member of this family. Families are not corporations. That is one of the superstitions of modern psychology or even of the family man. No, families must wither away in due time. They are transient. Then they must be refounded. A girl must have the power to say to her parents one day, I have to marry this man. She'll say it with a small voice. She is no longer afraid to say this now. But 5 years earlier, she wouldn't have not dared to think in these terms. She would not have told anybody that she was waiting for this man. But if the day comes when she can speak with conviction and convince the parents that they have to give in and they have to become the in-laws of this not desired and unexpected son-in-law, the time has been spent reasonably well. This girl has learned in 20 years or in 18 years to speak with power. This temporary mantle around the necessary decision for one member of the family to be emancipated in due time, this mantle of discretion is then falling to pieces at that right moment, usually without hurt. We are now this strange animal. Man is so plastic. We are born in such a manner that we have to change during our lifetime. And we found our special character during this lifetime on one word of decision. Therefore, we need around ourselves this play of time in order to find out when we in our generation have to become what we are meant to be. This plasticity is given us because we have to change the world during our lifetime. We cannot leave the world as it was when we were born into it. Now, any marriage is a very clear example of this fact that the whole human race is refounded. Again, this is today under modern conditions of rationalism forgotten. But when you pick your mate, you are not at all inside your country. You are founding potentially a new nation because your family, this new family, will have to be able to transfer its allegiance to another country. The Bible is written to show us that all the relations are refounded in such a case of one new love. We are told there how new nations can be founded. The Pilgrim Fathers always felt that they followed this example set in the Bible for Israel. The Jews, all of them, hail from Abraham and Sarah. Just two people marrying. And what is the importance of this, which you may ask? Well, these people have filled the world. Everybody speaks for or against them. We all are their spiritual descendants, a pope has said. We may like this or not. These people knew what they were doing. They were founding a new way of life together, and for this they had to forego old, embarrassing shame. Their marriage meant the creation of a new inside, and we cannot change the world as we have to unless we put into this world new partitions, new frontiers, new boundaries, new corporations, things that have not followed the same patterns and lines in the year of our birth, but from now on they shall. The decisions we make in this respect have to be timed. So the self-knowledge of which we spoke is only important when it coincides with timing. This means of producing the change does not come to us at all times of our life, but it comes in 1 hour of decision. The girl knows when to tell her parents. At this moment, she has to be at the top of her powers. Most people today think that every day must be like every other day. I'm afraid this is impossible. You have to have the exceptional days when you know more about yourself, when you are not afraid to be confronted with your destiny. On the other hand, it would be terrible if you would hold this in front of you all the time. This is me. When you tell your love story too early to anybody, or when you only tell it after you have failed, this knowledge of what you are planning to do or what you should have done is very useless. As we say, it is an afterthought, or it is premature. Students who talk too much about their sex experiences certainly are not the best candidates for marriage. Your whole problem in love is timing. That is why all untimely love affairs are not very serious. You may have physical instincts, urges, drunkenness, debauch, but the only thing you want is that this may be then covered up as we used to say with the mantle of Christian love, it was untimely. Also, you went while you were drunk and saw perhaps a girl. You don't wish to be forced now to marry this girl. You didn't mean it. I had such a case here in college some years ago. The boy was even on the verge of being separated from the college for it. He was a married man, and his wife had to live in Chicago. Here, the boy got drunk, and he brought a girl into his room. Well, you can imagine what effort it took us to get the authorities to condone. There was something to condone, to be sure. But it was obvious that the man was a very fine boy, and he was very passionate, and his passion had got the upper hand in a short circuit. His wife forgave him. Also, he was not separated, I'm glad to say, from college. But the condition for this pardon, obviously, had been that not too many people were allowed to know of it. The separation would have been inexorable if people had known. So the whole problem in this boy's case was how to keep it quiet, another aspect of shame or discretion, how to keep such a secret. Now I can talk about it, because the boy has left the school for several years. We saved his freedom, and connected with freedom, then shame shows its importance. It has two sides to it. When shame is respected by the world, we preserve our freedom. And inside, we must not wake up to what we have been done to our self-knowledge, except in the high moment, when we have to speak out. You mean by freedom very often something abstract, because you think it depends on your will. But our freedom is taken away from us by too much knowledge others have of us. If other people know too much of us, we give them power. When the government of Uncle Sam knows too much about our incomes, the income tax becomes very serious. It's a stepping stone to confiscation. Knowledge, the simple knowledge that we have to lay before the government all our sources of revenue, changes the whole situation of an American citizen, or has changed it, regardless of the percentage of income tax actually paid. I shall be glad to pay taxes, but it is a different matter that by opening up my books, I'm also beginning to give somebody else power over my life. Because once Uncle Sam knows how you make a living, he can begin to encroach upon your actions by which you make the living. This has nothing to do with financing the government. I'm not against the income tax, but I want you to understand that the simple knowledge of others, of what you are doing, creates a change in power. A man who knows too much of your record, the things that you would like to keep out of the limelight, can gain power over you, and they can retard your freedom. Therefore, when Jesus came into the world, to be more serious still now in my example, he had to time his coming, or he would have been frustrated. The premature knowledge of Herod threatened his life right away. The knowledge of the crowds and of the Pharisees and of the high priests, that here was a man who made the time come true, which they had forgotten to expect. The time to come and take the gospel out of Jerusalem and out of the temple and spread it all over the earth. Even a pious Jew today now says Jerusalem is everywhere on the earth. That he doesn't know that he can only say so now after 1900 years of Christian mission. The knowledge of these enemies of his step would have prevented Jesus from performing what he did perform. Let me explain this a little more. Let me speak, however, first of a man who had no sense of timing. The contrast helps. This man grew up to the ripe old age of 95. We used to go to him because he had a member of our faculty before, and we congratulated him nearly every year to some kind of anniversary. There was the 50th of his doctor examination, the 50th of his full professorship, the 50th anniversary of his widowhood, etc. But the poor man had no life anymore, and when he welcomed us, giving us some cake and a glass of wine, he said to me several times, "Death has forgotten me." He was a cold fish. His own son has told me so. And so he lived out of time with death forgetting him. That's a grave punishment. Simply to exist is not a blessing. Most people today, however, think it is. They think it is better to live up to 95 than to die at 35. I don't think seriously that you can uphold that Homer Lee, who did die at 35, died with an unfulfilled life, and that this my older colleague was not plagued by a curse. It is a punishment to live too short. It is a punishment to live too long. I know a very proud woman here in the neighborhood. The doctors had saved her, they said, from cancer by operating on her at the time when she was 82, had lived a full life, and felt she should be allowed to go. She had been very beautiful. She had been every right to be proud of the achievement of her life. She was a great grandmother. She expected the end. Her sister, her children expected the end. She should not have been forced to hang on, as they said, to allow these medical students to learn a little about cancer. Now, in normal days, nobody would have operated on her, and she would have been gone in peace. The other day, I wrote her a poem to console her over this fact that she had lost control of the form and shape of her life, that she was there like a helpless bundle, without connection with the way of life she had managed to live before. And she told me that this poem had comforted her because she at least knew that I did appreciate this terrible loss, this unnecessary loss of character which her life now underwent. It is not very much, but it is some comfort that you know that somebody else assesses the loss which befalls you. Shame and timing, then, go together from the cradle to the grave. And you cannot understand the importance of it if you think that we can think important thought outside of time. If you think that we must have one whole system that answers all the questions of life from the book. We should think because we are compelled in order to be free and to have the necessary knowledge for taking the next step, for coming true. We must know the truth. When we are forced to change in order to remain true out ourselves, then always self-knowledge comes to us, as in the case of the bride, as in the case of a man who resists a bribe. When you have to say to yourself, it is time for me now to get married, I have to defy my parents, it is time for me to give up this idea that I must become a doctor, it was premature, now I see that I should become somebody else. You free yourself from false pretenses, and you are very lucky when you feel that this freedom is still yours, that you can throw down the chains of a too early or of a wrong decision. In this moment, you need the fullest amount of self-consciousness. There's nothing praiseworthy, certainly, in ignorance, but there's nothing praiseworthy in a knowledge for its own sake out of the hour of decision. It is equally stupid to say the bliss of sheep or the bliss of wolf be with you. You have to be neither a wolf nor a sheep. Things ought to be known when we are ready for them and when they are ready for us. Nobody is always ready to read the Bible, for instance. I may open the New Testament today and be absolutely stymied because the day is not there to read it. But there are people who pretend that they can read the New Testament or the Old Testament or any holy text at all times with the same full understanding. Mistrust these people. They're probably physicists. They can train themselves by learning the outer things about the Bible and rereading them. But the decisive eye-opener usually comes to you when you have to read this book in order to be enlightened on a crisis in your own life. We may therefore, and I do invite you to do this, grade Grade, I say, all knowledge according to the closeness to our own lifetime, to our own decisions and importance. What the physicists tell you about yourself is of very slight importance. He tells you that you consist of atoms or of electrons or of whatever the fad of the day calls the latest unit. Now, what does it help you to know that you consist of billions of electrons? It doesn't help you at all. It is such an abstract vision of yourself that it doesn't make any difference. Therefore, you can know this all the time. You can be examined on it. This lowest kind of knowledge of yourself, you have 24 hours a day. You can write it on a blackboard, I am X electrons. But that's indifferent knowledge. It makes not the slightest difference. You don't recognize yourself in this description. You say it's true, probably true, I believe it, but this kind of belief is not a belief because you can't stake your life on it. It's so far away. It is only important with regards to those things of which we know nothing but that they are electrons. All the poor things that cannot speak to us, that we do not make love to, that are outside our real life. The things in a test tube, in an electric tube. Of course, they are described by these abstract terms. And you can know them all the time. If you, as I have heard an historian explain, wish to explain history from the glands, then you could understand all history of the human race at all times and put it in a system. But this isn't true. We all have the same glands, but we seem to use them for very different purposes. The heart of the matter, the center of the history of mankind, or the center of your own being, we can only know at certain times. God, we only know in the very rarest moment when he enters into us. Jesus declined, and therefore we come back now to the serious business of the discussion of the first full man. Jesus declined to call himself the Messiah, or to be called the Messiah in front of the crowds. He forbade it to his disciples. They did recognize him, he said, be silent. And only in the hour of his death did he allow Pontius Pilate to say, but you are the Messiah. And he said, you said it. He didn't even then say it himself at the last moment. And that is, on the highest level of human achievement, shame. If he had said it 1 hour earlier, if Jesus had said it for 30 years, we all would agree that he would have belonged to the lunatic asylum as a megalomaniac. The healthiest men of our race also had to show the health of bashfulness, shyness, and a lack of the constant mirror image held up to oneself. Who am I? This you must understand. For then you know the criterion between sanity and insanity. And don't make out Jesus as insane. Untimely self-knowledge usually condemns you to be a case of neurosis. The great truth of Jesus, that he was going to take Christianity out of the old Israel and to break down the partition between Jews and Greeks and to create a new nation, a new spiritual commonwealth. This he was not allowed to know 1 second too early. It unfolded during his whole lifetime that this was to be. But he must not say it. They must say it after he has gone. Some critics have thought that was faulty, that was his limitation, that was his strength. We call this the resurrection. If Jesus had said in his own lifetime who he was, the Jews would have dragged him through the mire as they tried to do it anyway later. They would have made him ridiculous. he would have been finished. Who he was could only be known afterwards, and therefore timing is the central element of the gospel. And you find this clearly stated in St. Matthew in the first book of the New Genesis, as it is called, the New Creation. There our genealogy is given. Every 14 generations, Matthew says, there's a tremendous earthquake in the world of faith. And it has been this way even before Jesus has come. So now, perhaps, you understand that the gospel has very little to say about virtues or vices. And that this whole exaggerated emphasis of liberal theologians on the Sermon on the Mount doesn't touch the heart of the gospel. Because Jesus could excel certainly and outdo rabbinical wisdom. Would this have made any difference, however, by itself? There can be still higher wisdom than he is saying in the Sermon on the Mount. Wisdom we can understand quite often. It's open. It's there. Not all the time is one able to understand the depths of the Sermon on the Mount. I grant you this. But very often we can follow the sublimity of the thought, and we can read an interpretation and master it. Therefore, the Sermon on the Mount cannot be the heart of the matter, for the simple reason that the gospel is meant to reveal the coming of the Lord. Now, something that can be repeated in your or my life at random cannot be divine. The academic clan does not like this idea that there could be anything higher to be said than what is known in a quiz on our exam or in a final exam as the ethical code of the Sermon on the Mount. Without risk of life, without jettisoning your success and your career, they think you can know the Christian truth. And so the whole theology of the last 200 years has tried to discuss Jesus' teachings, and to compare to other people's teachings. But that is not unimportant, as anybody may discover by opening his Bible. The men in the Bible found out God's timing. And he times very queer things. One time this is right, and one time something that just reads the opposite. Jesus had to walk like a tightrope walker between two dangers, between the too late and the too early. Anybody today will admit, I think, that Abraham's seed knew the truth about the oneness of God for all men already 2,000 years before Christ. Nobody else knew it perhaps so clearly, but their life's witness to the one God of all men had been quite efficient. It only came to an end before Christmas, and this end begot the Christ. There was no king in Israel who was a Jew. The son of the last conqueror of Herod himself was an Edomite from Esau, Jacob's brother. Therefore, that which had encouraged the Jews to hold on faithfully to their task for all men, David's kingship and David's temple, that had lapsed before Jesus was born. 10 years before Christ, the foreigner Herod had inaugurated David's temple anew. And when he died, this usurper, in 4 BC, he was followed by his equally foreign sons. And this was the first moment at which it became inevitable that God's offer to men had to be transformed into the seed of a new Israel. Because if nothing now happened, there would have been voided the whole tradition, beginning with Abraham, with Moses, David, Solomon, all together. Because now the prophecy that there would always be a truly Davidic king or priesthood left in Israel had gone out of existence.